Welcome to Local Talk, the Friday edition on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore people, stories, events, and places in central Iowa. Thank you for listening. I am Pat Schlarbaum, your host for the hour, with engineer Mike Murphy is here, our steady hand at the controls, and Mike Metz is here.
Good morning, Pat.
The keeper of the Prairie Winds Prairie Farm.
You know, what's really neat is the snow has melted because of our great weather the last couple days, but that's provided some water, and I've got some waterfowl visitors. A couple of green-winged teal, a few mallards, and I had one northern shoveler yesterday.
Oh, well, the shovelers, they're fun. It's out dipping its bill in the muck and getting those crustacean.
I think they're just taking a rest.
Yeah. Well, that's something to look forward to this weekend. Mm-hmm. We'll have a little bit of Indian summer for us later in the hour. Okay. And wanted to announce, I just learned over the holiday that there on Saturdays at 1 p.m., there's a YouTube, a live music performance that's worth checking out. And it's by the K3 Sisters Band. That's K as in Carrie. K3 Sisters Band. Apparently it's three sisters, and they're really listenable. So that's something to look forward to this weekend. Wish I had other live music to bring up, but that's all I have for today.
We'll keep a lookout for that. So
yeah.
Currently it's 27 degrees out there with a high temperature forecast today of up to 51 and a low tonight at 32, with warm forecast over the weekend around 52 on Saturday and 46 on Sunday. Temperatures will continue to get above freezing on Monday, around 50, then highs and lows, and then the lows will get down to the 30s later in the week. Our sunrise will be 7:17 a.m. today and sunset this evening at 4:46 p.m. with a waxing crescent moon. A fingernail moon.
Yeah. There's a conference to announce. The Women Food and Ag Network Conference will be held virtually December 2nd and 3rd. Prior to the weekend event, participants will be gathering in Grinnell for a regional meetup. And please register and join the group in Grinnell on December 1 from 4:30 to 6:30. And that's the pre-conference gathering. And that's the Women Food and Ag Network. Later in the hour, we'll have Wolf Osterich at Ada Hayden Heritage Park. At first, let's welcome Dennis Hart with a news summary from this past week from the pages of the Ames Tribune.
Wintertime respiratory viruses strike Iowa with a vengeance. Another possible shot at revamping Grand Avenue in Ames. And goodbye to that swan on Lake Laverne on the Iowa State University campus. All part of what made news this Thanksgiving week in the Ames Tribune. Let's start with last Friday's paper, which reported that wintertime respiratory viruses had returned to Iowa, including one that poses a greater risk to the very young and to the very old. Health officials here and elsewhere have seen an unusually early uptick in RSV. Federal health experts think the virus might be having an outsized impact on young children because many of those children being infected have not been exposed over the past couple of years when they were isolating or social distancing during the coronavirus pandemic. There is no vaccine for RSV. There was also word that the city of Ames may take another shot at revamping Grand Avenue. 15 years ago, Ames residents stopped a plan to widen Grand and 13th Street. Now, the city has plans to revamp the project to address safety issues and expand it to other intersections. A new project design recommends widening Grand and 13th and also proposes projects at intersections from 9th to 24th Street. A shared-use path would run the entire length of Grand Avenue, and pedestrian walk lights would either be added or enhanced at each intersection. The entire project could cost more than $5 million and be finished by 2029 at the earliest. And the Trib reported that another well-known personality from KCCI-TV, the top-rated television news operation in Des Moines, would soon be retiring. Steve Carlin has been with Channel 8 for 34 years. He and Stacy Horst had teamed up to anchor the nightly newscast in 2015, following the retirement of longtime anchor Kevin Cooney. Steve had already done a variety of other on-air jobs at the station before getting the prime anchor assignment, the one that had been filled over the previous decades by the legendary Russ Van Dyke and Paul Rhodes and, yes, Kevin Cooney. Steve's soon-to-be retirement comes after longtime KCCI weathercaster Curtis Gertz retired 18 months ago. So, yes, times are changing at Central Iowa's top TV newscast. But we still have time to watch Steve Carlin. He'll be on the air for a few more months, until March of next year. Saturday's paper reported that the state's coronavirus infection rate had gone up slightly from the week before, but that hospitalizations from the virus had declined about 25% from the previous week. 1,980 new infections were reported in Iowa, a 6% hike from the week earlier. The number of people hospitalized with the virus in Iowa last week was 137, a decline from the 180 of the week before. And 24 new deaths were reported from the virus, bringing the total number of deaths in Iowa from the coronavirus to 10,253 since the pandemic began. The Trib also had word about the closing of a hospital in Keokuk. Blessing Health Keokuk shut its doors October 1st, meaning the community lost its only hospital. The nearest 24-hour emergency care is now located at least 25 minutes away. And experts say more closures could be on the way because the state's smallest hospitals are facing increasing problems with staffing shortages and rising costs to provide care that are not matched by insurance reimbursement. And the Trib reported that the Ames School District is crafting its definition of educational equity and that some students at a recent board meeting were concerned it would not include diverse books. Four students with the high school group Students Advocating for Civil Rights spoke at the meeting with concerns that some books were being removed from school shelves. But the students did not name any books, and District Superintendent Julius Lawson said he was not aware of any books being removed. The district has been reviewing its equity work since the departure of its first equity director earlier this year and the start of Lawson's tenure as superintendent in July. Sunday's paper reported that a Polk County judge had set a hearing for January 18th for Piper Lewis, a sex trafficking victim who had received probation at a women's center in Des Moines after she had killed a man who she said had raped her. The 18-year-old Lewis now faces prison time after she cut off a GPS tracking device she was required to wear and left the women's center. Des Moines police arrested her a few days later. She had pleaded guilty to voluntary manslaughter in the stabbing death of Zachary Brooks, but a judge had given her a deferred sentence, put her on probation, and told her she had a one and only second chance. The Trib also reported that the mute swan that has paddled alone on Iowa State University's Lake Laverne since the death of its partner is going to retire. She soon will have company at a family's private pond. Meanwhile, the university is making plans to welcome a new pair of birds. Lancelot and Elaine have been the names of the swan pairs that have lived on Lake Laverne since they were first introduced there in 1935. The most recent pair was introduced in 2003. Both swans were female, so while it's impossible to know which bird died of natural causes in June, a university press release named the survivor Elaine. So now, Elaine the survivor will retire from the lake and have a new home at an acreage near Woodward owned by ISU alumni. That family raises swans. Lake Laverne will temporarily be without swans, but a new pair of birds eventually will be introduced to that lake. There was also a story about the University of Northern Iowa's plans for a new undergraduate nursing program. Plans are to open that program in the fall of 2024. It's expected there will be about 24 students in the first class. 96 students would be required so the program can generate enough tuition revenue to exceed the program's costs. There was more last Sunday, including a story about awards given to people and organizations who have made a difference in Ames and Story County. The Story County Alliance for Philanthropy presented the awards at its annual luncheon. They went to Woodruff Construction, the Ames Noon Kiwanis Club, the Ames Middle School Kiwanis Builders Club, to Al and Karen Hermanson, and to Dr. John Fleming. And, of course, the Trib's website had word about Saturday's Iowa State University football game against Texas Tech at Jack Trice Stadium. Texas Tech won 14-10. Tuesday's paper reported that the Ames company that wants to build a more than $4 billion carbon capture pipeline across Iowa had sued Story County and Shelby County over new ordinances that would require increased distances between the projects and homes, churches, and schools. Summit Carbon Solutions says county supervisors adopted ordinances that try to preempt state and federal oversight. Two other companies have also proposed carbon capture pipelines, and other counties are also weighing setback ordinances. And the State Utilities Board is considering whether federal law preempts the state from imposing safety requirements when permitting the carbon capture pipeline projects. The Trib also reported that a group of Ames parents and students had complained to the school board about a previous decision they said limits students' opportunities to prepare for college. In June, The school board effectively ended district-paid access to courses at Iowa State University, if those courses are also offered at the Des Moines Area Community College. Students now must take what's offered at the community college or pay for the courses out of pocket at ISU. Parents and students have told the board they get better experiences at the ISU courses and that those credits are more easily transferred when students enroll in college. And the Trib had word about where free Thanksgiving meals would be available. Food at First was set to host its annual free meal on Thanksgiving Day at First Christian Church in Ames. Options included dine-in, carry-out, and delivery. Organizers expected to serve about 800 meals. In Boone, the First United Methodist Church was getting set to offer free meals, including dine-in and drive-through options. Seating at the dine-in meal was limited to 144 people. Wednesday's Trib reported that a national utilities group was warning that Iowans and other Midwesterners are at risk of what it called energy emergencies because of power plant retirements, possible natural gas and coal shortages, and railroad disruptions. The North American Electric Reliability Corporation said the winter power reserve of Iowa's power grid operator is 5% below last winter's because of nuclear and coal power plant retirements. The Mid-Continent Independent System Operator is the grid operator in Iowa and 14 other states. It said an extreme cold weather event that extends deep into the area could lead to what it called high generator outages from inadequate weatherization and unavailability of fuel for natural gas-fired generators. But Iowa's biggest utilities, MidAmerican Energy and Alliant Energy, said they're prepared for the upcoming winter. And the Trib reported that Story City was getting set to hold its annual Yule Fest tree lighting ceremony tonight, Friday. The tradition started way back in 1914, when Story City became one of the first communities in the United States to have a lighted municipal tree. That first tree was about 30 feet tall and had about 250 electric lights. Tonight's celebration starts at 5 with the annual chili and soup dinner at the Story City Fire Station, with the tree lighting ceremony starting at 6. Yesterday's Trib, the Thanksgiving Day edition, reported that students at Gilbert High School had come together to build a more welcoming environment after two classmates had died by suicide in the past 3 years. They formed a group called Moving Forward to help build social connections between students. They've hosted several free social gatherings. The Trib also reported that experts said holiday spending this year will be about 6% higher than last year. And it reported that major retailers in Ames were closed yesterday for Thanksgiving Day, but plan to be open early today, Black Friday. In fact, if you're listening to this live edition of Local Talk just after 7 o'clock on this Friday morning, those retail outlets have already opened their doors. And there you have it, your summary of the Thanksgiving week news from the pages of the Ames Tribune. I'm Dennis Hart. Thank you so much for tuning in. I'm heading outside now to put up some Christmas lights, but I'll plan to come back inside at least by this coming Monday morning, when I'll report on what's been making news all around Iowa. I hope you can be here as well. Between now and then, go ahead. Have a safe, healthy, and happy holiday weekend.
And that was in recognition of Native American Month. That was Bill Miller, Not Too Far. You're a stone high on the mountains, If you're a bird high in the tree, if you're a flower out in the field, if you're a boat out on the sea, no matter where you are, you're not too far from me. And that's in recognition of Dave Conrads with the Iowa Raptor Project, formerly the McBride Raptor Project, with a story about falconers. And as falconers, they become one with their birds to fly a hawk over the gathered multitude of Iowa Hawkeye fans at Kinnick Stadium during Iowa football games. And yes, planning to fly later today with their big game with Nebraska. Go Hawks! Dave Conrads, welcome to Local Talk.
Thank you for having me, Pat.
And I'm talking to you there in Iowa City. You're a Hawkeye, and we're going to be talking about the Hawkeyes, the Hawks.
Yeah, so the name is now the Iowa Raptor Project, and it's in the University of Iowa College of Education as part of the UI Wild program. We wanted to capture the fact that it's that we serve a more broad audience than just the McBride, Lake McBride area.
Sure, and a raptor is a bird of prey. We're talking about eagles, hawks, ospreys, turkey vultures, owls, those birds of prey. The work that you're doing involves these birds, and quite often it's networking with falconers. Do you have experience with raptors?
Yeah, that's a great question. So, you know, way back when, starting in the fall of 1987, John Strawbers, you know, had gotten some money from the DNR non-game program, now Iowa, the Wildlife Diversity Program, to do a little study of birds of prey migration on the Mississippi River, and that's how I got my feet wet there. John was a former student with me at Central College.
In Pella.
The birds of prey. Yeah, yep.
Yeah, and John is a familiar name to our listeners. He's a member of the Big Blue Sky music that we will weave in here and include. So, yeah, John's a pretty important individual in the world of raptors.
He is, though not a falconer. I know your question was about falconry. Yeah. But that's how I got first started with birds of prey. And then, you know, when you and I first really met was in the summer of 1989 with the peregrine reintroduction in Cedar Rapids. And that's when I really got to know some of the falconers here in Iowa and their passion for bringing back peregrine and their passion for all falcons and birds of prey.
Yeah, there was a Midwestern effort to bring peregrines back to the cities, and peregrine falcon are kind of the standard bearer of the Endangered Species Act non-game program. The Department of Natural Resources hired Dave Conrads and Wendy Vandewall to be our falcon stewards in Cedar Rapids and releasing birds there in 1989 and 1990. But we met in 89. So you've had an interest in falconry, it sounds like, or working with raptors, birds of prey. And pretty exciting. I'm hearing now that there's a hawk that's flying over Kinnick Stadium during the football games.
Yeah. When I got hired at the university in 1990, after finishing my grad school work at UNI, they hired me to be the director of the, like you said, at that time it was called actually the McBride Raptor Center. And even then, when the Warren Slabus was the guy who hired me, and even I think in our interview, he was talking about how cool it would be to have a live hawk. You know, we are the Hawkeyes, and it'd be really cool to have a live hawk at the games. And so it's been something that people have chatted about for years and years. In fact, we have images of red-tailed hawks being at games on the glove as early as the 50s. And one of them even had the label of Hercules, which is, of course, is where the caricature Herky the hawk comes from. It's a shortened name of Hercules.
Yeah.
So it's been stirring for quite a while. And then when we hired our most recent Iowa Raptor Project director, we hired Ryan Anthony from Fish and Wildlife Service, who happened to be a master falconer per Iowa code. To oversee a bird of prey, you know, educational display like ours, you need a master rehabilitator permit or a master falconer permit. Since we aren't active in rehabilitation anymore and more focused on education and research, it's really fitting to bring in Ryan as a master falconer. And then with Ryan, we also hired a new assistant director who's funded by Kirkwood Community College, and she also is a Master Falconer, and they happen to be married. So it's Ryan and Holly Anthony is our kind of lead team now for directing the Raptor Project in this program with athletics and flying birds.
You mentioned the educational potential or opportunity that these raptors present. I'm sure our listeners have, if they haven't witnessed a live presentation with a live bird of prey, they've kind of missed out, but there are educational birds. And yet, how do you feel about how that is a great way to make your points, but relatively, or in a sense, unfortunate that these are injured birds and they kind of get a new life, if you will?
Yeah. Originally, the birds that we only used for educational programming were, like you said, injured birds that were unable to be released into the wild. And so we at least talk about this as they serve as icons to tell larger conservation stories. So even our wildlife camps we have here, we talk about the importance of how, you know, we connect like falcons to prairie and hawks to woodlands and eagles to wetlands. It's kind of just iconic storytellers, and they represent everything else underneath them. With the birds we have that we fly, obviously they're not physically injured. The birds we actually are flying at Kinnick are birds that had been bred in captivity for falconry purposes. Our original bird that we flew last year, and she's still capable of flying, is a dark morph western red-tailed hawk that was bred in captivity, but whose parents had stepped on its eye. And so it's actually missing, it's one-eyed. And so that bird actually is like injured. The other bird that we've been flying is a Harris's hawk that was bred in captivity for falconry purposes. We're using Walter for educational purposes.
I see the link here.
Really, it's more fitting for us at the university. It was decided to go the direction of focusing on research and education.
And with iconic birds that, again, can really capture people's sense of importance, if you will, to share the same airspace with a bird of prey when it's on someone's fist is something that you can see it in the kids' eyes. They it's just so unique. It always works.
I couldn't agree more, Pat. There's something very powerful to be in the presence of a wild animal, and especially the birds of prey that we have just been throughout the decades now have been just very powerful, again, icons for the conservation education program we're doing.
I think you mentioned a date, 1990. So it was apparently the having the bird fly at Kinnick has been talked about and maybe envisioned, and then lo and behold, you got the people that were capable of working one-on-one with a bird. And what was that like? Kind of give us some backstory, if you would. Undoubtedly went to the stadium before there were people there,
right,
and kind of worked on this. And how did that go initially?
Yeah, that's a great question. So, the conversation was really initiated by athletics, and they had a genuine interest in promoting birds of prey and conservation message. So they came to us and asked what we thought about the potential of bringing a bird into the stadium and even getting to the point of flying. And again, with Ryan and Holly and their skills and interest, it really was a good fit. And so once it was agreed that we would do it, this was last year, it was our first year, then we were able to get the red-tailed hawk and the Harris's hawk and begin training. And so, in the empty stadium, you begin, after they've molted out, you don't want to interrupt a bird's molt. And so it was, I think it was in mid-August last year, we began training the birds, getting them used to flying to the glove. And then it was really fun to see the light bulbs click for the birds when we started out in the field flying them on what's called a creance, kind of like a long leash.
Yeah.
And then been to the free flight part where, you know, that bird's free to fly away if it wanted to, but with the positive reinforcement of feeding the bird on the glove, they'll fly to that glove. And we do have like a couple of transmitters on the birds just in case they do, you know, leave the stadium, so we're able to retrieve them. They've never left the stadium, but we're prepared for that.
Uh-huh.
We just kept moving them up, and then finally from the fourth floor in the press box, that was the big movement from flying from the top down to midfield, and they've been doing it successfully since we started, so it's been pretty cool to see that process.
Yeah, pretty cool indeed. So the chance to see that is kind of like it's another, let's refer to it as an iconic moment. I know that the crowd gives the wave to the children's hospital, that's quite a feature now to the Kinnick Stadium audience, if you will. But now to have this hawk flying over the people, that just seems pretty fulfilling if you're a Hawkeye.
Yeah, it really is. And we've had so many people who said, you know, we really never heard about this program but until you started doing this, then, you know, we obviously you got an audience of about 70,000 each game, you know, that you have an opportunity to share. And then what also is cool for me, and I know it would be for you as well, how much more excited they are that, like, we hear people like, I'm looking for hawks in the wild now, or I'm seeing things, you know, like they're paying attention. And that's so important, Pat, isn't it? You know, that's what we're trying to do it's not a circus act, you know.
Yeah.
This is actually to generate like we use the terms awaken awareness, nurture appreciation, and inspire action for all things wild. And this is part of that process, to really awaken awareness, and then hopefully, you know, the appreciation forms. Now, last week was really an interesting moment that we'd never had before. We have wild red-tailed hawks that live and nest even on campus, right? Actually, a pair nested on the crane in front of the hospital right across the street this past summer. So we got these red-tails that are living in the neighborhood, and this is the first time I've seen this at a football game. Right before we were to go out, a wild red-tailed hawk flies below the press box, but over the crowd. And all these people are like confused. And I got asked, is that your bird? Did it get loose?
Yeah, sure.
But what was cool is that people were paying attention and they were looking for, and it was just such a cool teachable moment. The bird, you know, flew out of the stadium, and a couple minutes later, it was time to release our bird. But it was just a neat moment to, you know, to see that the people are looking and watching and learning as you go. It's really fun.
Well, thank you so much for sharing your inspiration. Is there anything else, Dave Conrads? What a feature you've brought to the Hawkeye State.
Well, nothing more than to say, you know, I know you're in Cyclone country there, and when you're not playing the Hawkeyes, we're Cyclone fans too. But really, you know, I think for all of us as Iowans, we're united and hopefully in the passion of conserving the precious natural resources we still have.
What a voice you are for conservation, Dave Conrads. You're the director of the Iowa Raptor Project, and thank you so much.
Well, I'm not the director of the Iowa Raptor Project. That's Ryan Anthony, but I'm director of UI Wild.
Oh.
And the Raptor Project is one of our three flagship programs.
But you are essentially with Iowa Wild, you say?
Yeah, it's called UI Wild. So Wild is an acronym for Wildlife Instruction and Leadership Development. It's in the College of Education.
Send me your website. We'll have that on our website. Thank you so much, Dave Conrads.
You bet, Pat. Great talking with you.
Yeah, thanks, Dave. Hey, you've really done well, young man. And you're really doing good. And go Hawks. It's 7:30. 30 minutes after the hour, and you're listening to KHUI Community Radio on 89.1 FM, and I'm Pat Schlarbaum on Friday Local Talk with co-host Mike Metz and engineer Mike Murphy.
And I just want to briefly say, Pat, that it's the 100-year anniversary of the birth of Charles Schultz and cartoonist for the Peanuts strip. And I just think we ought to just listen in, or at least think of them. A great little strip that we had learned about little kids, you know. We could all identify. Concentrate on their little foibles and problems and kids and critters.
So. I think it's happy music.
There you go.
Hey, Susan Gwiazda has today away from her City of Ames desk, yet hoping you're enjoying your Thanksgiving break, Susan. And thank you from all of us at KHOI for all that you do for the City of Ames and Community Radio. Let's welcome Gabriella Edwards, City Forester, with a pre-recorded piece from earlier this week. Gabrielle Edwards, is it okay to call you Gabby?
Yes, that's perfect.
Oh, okay, okay. And you're our new forester for the City of Ames.
Correct, yep. I've been with the City of Ames since about the end of August. I'm going into just wrapping up my third month and heading into my fourth.
Yeah, this is tree pruning time of year, among other things, I guess, or is that correct?
Yes, it is. So winter months, unfortunately, due to the cold, right, for us, but winter months are actually the best time to be pruning trees across the community. And that's one thing that our Parks and Recreation crew is going to shift into in the next few weeks, is working on pruning trees across the community. It's the best time to do it for the health of the tree, as well as just promoting the recovery, the healthy recovery of the tree from the pruning wounds that you create. Winter is really the ideal time.
Yeah, well, doing it right is, I like this topic. I'm aware of the oak blight that will attack trees if you prune in the summer. Is that correct?
Correct. So it's a disease called oak wilt. It is especially prevalent in red oaks. So red oak, scarlet oak, several of the other kind of oaks that you see that little tassel point at the end of the leaves, those are red oaks. And what it is it's actually spread. It's a pathogen that's spread by beetles, nidodulid beetles specifically. Basically, they're called picnic beetles. They're the tiny little black bugs that bother you when you're outside in the summertime and you're eating food or drinking beverages. Those are the beetles that spread it. So we say that oaks, if at all possible, should not be pruned in the summertime because of the prevalence of those insects and the ability for that disease to spread. Oak wilt has been seen to fully kill a mature oak tree over the course of about 2 years. So it's very rapid, and it can have a lot of problems in that way. So we especially try to wait to prune oaks until it's cold and there are no insects out flying around.
And you mentioned the red oaks. I really like the, they kind of hang on to their leaves.
Yes, yep. And it varies by species of oak tree. So some hang on to their leaves a little bit longer than others. And you'll see other species that will carry them over throughout the entire winter months. The one that is specific in my mind that I'm looking for as a problem if I see leaves on the trees is a bur oak tree. So bur oaks are the ones that are kind of just really gnarly looking. The branches are really full of movement, and just they're called wolf trees. They're just big, majestic trees. Those are the bur oaks, and they should be losing their leaves every winter. However, they have a separate disease, separate from oak wilt, called bur oak blight. It was actually kind of categorized by a professor here at Iowa State University. And what that is it's a fungus that attacks the tree right at the connection point between the leaf and the stem, which causes the leaves to hold on over the winter months. And then that's how the fungus spreads in the springtime with spring rain. And it kind of goes throughout the canopy that way. So if you see bur oaks holding onto their leaves, that's a sign of a problem.
Oh.
But it varies by other species whether they hang onto their leaves in the winter or not.
I think I've been noticing that because I like to notice the bur oaks. I love their lateral branches. And they are the savanna species for prairie areas.
Yes, yep. And a lot of people know quite a few years ago there was this big thing called bat tree. It was a man in Wisconsin that took a picture of a tree on a hill in a farm. every day for a year. That was a bur oak tree. Yeah. So that's kind of like the quintessential image that people think of when they think of a bur oak out on a savanna is that tree.
Yeah. Yes. Hey, something I'm going to kind of weave in to get back to the red oaks. I went to that winter texture that I enjoy. But it's those little bugs, are they what people call no-see-ums?
No, they're not the no-see-ums.
Oh, okay.
Those are a bit smaller. The nidadulid beetles are a little bit bigger and a little bit easier to see than the no-see-ums.
Oh, okay.
But yeah, they're still like a small black insect. And I am by no means an entomologist. They all kind of look about the same, but I can tell apart a nidadulid beetle and a no-see-um for sure.
Yeah, I've been known to curse the no-see-ums to the point where it wouldn't be appropriate for radio listening because, man, they're just the little tiny things, but oh boy.
Yeah, they punch and bite for sure.
It drove me nuts. Anyway, you're in quite a position as an urban forester. How did this grow into your professional perspective of what you'd like to devote your life to?
So I've always been a person that has loved the balance between being by myself outdoors and also being surrounded by people. And so I'm a little bit of a juxtaposition in that way. And so while I was going through school at Iowa State, I was always drawn to natural resources. And so forestry and environmental science were kind of my jam. But at the same time, I wasn't all that interested in going out and doing like timber cruising the mountains by myself in Montana.
Well, what brought you to Iowa State?
I come from a family where I have three older siblings, and for various reasons, all three of my older siblings went to Iowa State. I mean, I'm quite a bit younger than my closest sibling, so he's 10 years older than me. Mm-hmm. So when I was, when he was going off to college at 18, I was 8 and drug along with my parents to all of the different events that they went to for my older siblings here at Iowa State. And so to me, it was kind of a bit of a logical path for me to go to Iowa State.
Yeah, you were familiar with
it. Yeah, yep, exactly. Yeah. I kind of grew up here in Iowa State, even though I'm actually from Northeast Iowa.
Uh-huh.
But and the same sort of kind of natural progression happened for me for urban forestry as a career. So I like being outdoors. I like natural resources. That is my passion. And at the same time, I'm equally passionate about people, relationships, dynamics, and the connection between people and nature, right? And so to me, urban forestry struck that perfect balance between being natural resources oriented and focusing on ecosystems and developing ecosystems in tandem with developing communities right along the same path. And so that's really where urban forestry really hit it home for me for that perfect combination, for sure.
Sure, sure. And as our metropolis areas, we're attempting to coexist with nature. And like back in the 60s, it seemed like suburbia, everything was just growing by leaps and bounds. And then there became an awareness of, hey, but the natural resources bring us a lot of quality of life issues in our urban areas. So maybe we should maybe we should go down that path. And I think we're better for it. But maybe I have a biased opinion. But
well, you and me both in that. And
okay.
And there are many studies that are coming out now, particularly in the health field. So you think like medical doctors that are completing studies about the relationships between green space and trees. Mm-hmm. To our actual physical well-being. And there are a lot of connections being drawn between being outside, seeing green space, being able to have a value and being able to participate in outdoor recreation can have tangible health benefits, reduce stress, reduce anxiety, reduce blood pressure, help with cognition as we age, many actual tangible benefits of trees related to our well-being.
Yeah, these are wonderful topics, wonderful highlights, if you will, for the profession of an urban forester that we're visiting with this morning. And Gabrielle Edwards, is there other things that you would like to emphasize in this winter season?
Yeah, so we kind of touched on it at the beginning, but the winter months are really the perfect time to be pruning. And just like planting a tree and just like everything else in life, there is a right and a wrong way to prune your trees. The things that we're looking for when we look at pruning trees across the community, we look for dead and dying branches. The branch is dead, or you're seeing like black or the bark coming off of it. It's a sign that, you know, that branch is no longer living and should be removed. You're also looking for branches that might cross. The way trees grow is they just kind of stay where they are. They don't move within the tree. They just increase their diameter over time. And so tree branches that are rubbing will eventually end up growing into each other, essentially. And that will create a weak point for future breakage. There are several things that you're looking for when you prune. Identifying those, and you can find that information out online, or I'm happy to answer any questions that we have. And then how you prune is also incredibly important. And what you're going for there is this delicate balance around the scientific term is the branch bark ridge. So it's basically where the branch intersects with the trunk of the tree. There's this special little area in the biology of the tree. And basically, it's kind of like the wound healing area for the tree. And so when you make your cut, you want to be very careful about where you're making your final pruning cut, to be just on the outside of that branch bark ridge. So that way you'll get a really nice wound closure. Oftentimes when you see pruning cuts, you might see like a horseshoe shape, that rounded, almost donut looking shape that comes out to seal over that wound. And you want to have that full wound sealed so that way you don't have decay or moisture or any sort of bad beetles or funguses getting in that wound and causing the decline of the tree. And so making the right pruning cuts and then doing the pruning cut correctly is very important, especially as we're going into the tree pruning season of winter.
Yeah. And I'm sure there's YouTube videos to illustrate this. I've often thought of that area of the branch bark ridge as a collar, you know, just kind of like an enlarged area that, but it's ready to heal the branch that you're removing or that branch space. And
And sometimes it is very obvious. Sometimes it does look like a little swollen area right where the branch intersects with the trunk of the tree. And then it makes our jobs a lot easier, because it's a lot easier to see the visual of it. But yes, there are plenty of videos and information from Iowa State University as well as the Iowa DNR to check out for information about where you're looking for when you're making your pruning cuts and what you should be pruning when you're out there looking at your trees.
Well, and just to kind of go back, you had a previous career with the Iowa Department of Natural Resources.
Correct. Yep. For about 5 years, I was an urban forestry specialist with the Iowa Department of Natural Resources. So I worked out of Des Moines. However, I covered the entire state, assisting communities of all different sizes with their urban forestry needs. And so having a city forester, like the position I have now in Ames, is actually relatively unique across the state. There are only maybe a dozen or so in the state with all the different communities that we have. And that means that the vast majority, the other 900 or so communities across the state, don't have anybody with the expertise or skills to be able to manage their trees appropriately. And so that was a service that I provided with the DNR, was helping communities know what they have, helping answer questions about how to manage what they have and growing urban canopies across the state with the Iowa DNR. And I'm happy to be here, and I've lived in Ames for many years now, and I went to college here, as I mentioned, and so this is feels like home to me, and so I'm very happy to be able to bring my experience and my expertise directly to my community to help help grow and strengthen Ames as a fellow resident as well.
Yeah, as here at KHOI, we try to strengthen our community through communication and having voices like yours on essentially the front lines of a very important resource. I can't wait to hear more plans about the new park way off in Northwest, maybe along College Creek, or how are you referring to that new area?
I don't believe it has anywhere near a name yet. We've kind of been referring to it as the Sands McDormand property because that's the landowners is the Sands McDormand Family Trust. And so the city is in the process of purchasing that. We were actually just awarded a REAP grant from Iowa DNR to assist with the purchase of that park. And we're all very excited about the potential to bring a large community park to Western Ames. That's kind of where I live, so I'm especially excited because I can't wait to take advantage of that property from my own personal life, but also from a professional side to be able to bring, enhance the recreation opportunities already available in the city with another park for our residents. It's, it's a very exciting time.
Yeah, there's a really nice water feature, and there were, it was like a sheep pasture for a number of years. It was just perfect for bluebirds. So I predict that one of your keystone species out there in that new park is going to be enjoying the bluebirds along the along your trails. Well, Gabrielle Edwards, thank you so much for coming on Local Talk, and hope you had a nice Thanksgiving and have a great weekend.
Thank you. You as well. Happy to be here.
Okay. Well, that was from Gabrielle Edwards, the new city forester here in Ames. Hey, but let's welcome Wolf Ostrich with Big Blue Stem Audubon and a friend of Ada Hated Heritage Park. Hi, Wolf.
Good morning, Pat and Mike.
Great to have you with us once again.
Yeah, it's kind of cold out here, but it's a beautiful morning.
So you're right there at Ada Hayden.
That's correct.
And what are you seeing for waterfowl these days?
Well, not as much as I had hoped to by now, but it's mostly Canada geese and mallards. And then we'll get a few of other ducks. I mean, we've had common mergansers, ruddy duck, gadwall, green-winged teal.
Yeah, Mike mentioned he had some green-winged teal on his marsh. So and the weather has been...
I said that we have two green-winged teal today still. And then we had five adult trumpeter swans, but they've already taken off.
Okay, so I was going to... hoping to hear some reports on trumpeter swans, those big white birds that everybody is becoming so enamored with. Hearing a lot of reports of tundra swans, the kind of the cousin to the trumpeter, over on the Mississippi.
Yeah, we occasionally get them here in the wintertime. Like, I think last few winters we had at least one or two that, that stayed with the trumpeters.
Yeah, oh, sure. So how do you differentiate between tundra swans and trumpeter swans?
Well, the tundras are slightly smaller, and then they most of them will have a little yellow patch on the upper end of the bill next to the face.
Oh, sure.
And the shape of the bill is a little different, too.
Now, the trumpeters
sound different.
Yeah, the trumpeter swans, a lot of work in bringing trumpeter swans to Iowa. I think they returned as a nesting species in 1998, so we're relatively early on into this recovery. But more and more trumpeter swans in overwintering in Iowa. And what can we anticipate? How many was a good number last year?
Between probably 100 to almost 300.
300 trumpeter swans. My goodness. Yeah.
Yeah. And then mostly on the South Lake, because the North Lake would be all completely frozen over. And then there's usually a hole in the South Lake kept open by the all the waterfowl. And you get to see all those trumpeters in there mixed in with the Canadas. Hearing them take off or seeing them take off as they splash across the water with their feet and everything, and then the notes that they call, just beautiful.
Yeah, they're pretty special. I know they were have really enamored. A lot of Iowans are enjoying the trumpeter swans. And quite frankly, without the Canada geese keeping that hole in Ada Hayden, the trumpeters have to have open water every day. It's something to do with the circulation in their legs and then their feet, big old feet that they have. So they have to dangle in water every day. And lacking that open hole, they would be moving further south, which they did historically. But more and more overwintering trumpeter swans as a benefit from the Canada geese flock that, that keep that, that open water available.
And the benefit of the farmers who are not quite super efficient with all the grain it left out in the field.
Yeah, they. I guess they're, early on we kind of wondered, or the Department of Natural Resources, how the foraging would go. But in following the Canada geese, they usually know where there's some opportune corn to be enjoyed or appreciated by the trumpeter swans. I know friends out in Idaho tell me that the trumpeter swans out there do go out and forage the potato fields, and they eat potatoes in Idaho.
Oh, wow.
Believe it or not.
They have their little shovels so they can dig them up?
Yeah, right. Let's not go there, but there's foraging to do. But they do have big feet. They really do have massively big feet.
Shovelers, northern shovelers accompany them, Wolf. Hey, Wolf, what are you seeing along the trails as far as sparrows, that kind of thing? I've got quite a few Harris sparrows and, of course, juncos and things in the yard and around the edge of the prairie. What are you seeing out there?
Lots of American tree sparrows, a few white-crowned sparrows. The number of sparrows have gone down since about a week ago, but we're still seeing also a handful of Harris sparrow, some song sparrows. That's really about it, because all the other ones, like the swamp sparrow, the Lincoln sparrow, they've all already moved south.
Sure.
And I'm feeding a few of the Eurasian tree sparrows.
Mm-hmm. Yep, we still have the two females here. I see them not every day, but one on the north along the upland trail, and then one on the south side where those houses are.
Now, why are the... And why would the Eurasian tree sparrows be of significance?
Well, there are species that were introduced into Missouri in, the late 1800s around St. Louis, St. Charles area, and they've slowly made their way up the Mississippi River Valley, and they've been in southeast Iowa for many years, and they're slowly spreading out throughout Iowa. I've even had reports of a friend out in Boone County who's got some at his feeder, so that's kind of neat.
Yeah, they're kind
of go to southeast Iowa to see them, and now we have them in our backyard.
Yeah, good point. When 30, 40 years ago, it was kind of a destination to go to southeast Iowa to include Eurasian tree sparrows. And could you describe what you see that kind of stands out in their field marks?
Well, the male and female look the same. They're slightly smaller than the house sparrow. They have a rufous brown crown, whereas the house sparrow has got rufous brown on the sides of the crown and then the gray in the middle. So there's a big difference. And then on the cheek, it's kind of a whitish cheek with a black spot.
Yeah, what you would think of as the cheek of a songbird face, a big black area, that it kind of stands out.
Yes, it does.
Mm-hmm.
And the smaller size. As far as I know, we only have the two females here. One breeds with a house sparrow and one breeds with a hybrid.
Oh, okay. Very interesting indeed.
Wolf, I've got two quick questions for you. One is, there was a YouTube quick video of a bobcat that was seen out at Ada Hayden. Do you know anything about that?
Oh, yeah. One of our trail cams caught it, so that was kind of neat. I always expected that they are moving through here, but never seen one. Keep looking, but that's kind
of
nice.
Of course, you're usually, when you're out that way, it's during the daylight hours, and they're pretty much crepuscular or nocturnal.
Right. This one was caught on camera about, 3:30 in the morning.
Mm-hmm. The other question I had, Wolf, is... In December, it's the start of the Christmas bird counts or the winter bird counts. How is Ada Hayden a part of the bird count in Ames, which will be the 17th this year?
Well, Ada Hayden is part of the northwest corner of the Ames count. I have some team members that will cover it in the morning and then come back later in the afternoon.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll try to count all the birds that we see, not just species numbers, but also individual numbers of each species.
Okay.
And I'll be riding around and walking around the park.
Sure.
Trying to hit all the different types of habitat.
Very good.
And what is that website that Friends of Ada Hayden can tune in to some of these rare sightings like the bobcat?
You can go to the blog site is Friends of Ada Hayden. Well, Google Friends of Ada Hayden Heritage Park and then click on Reflections. Or you can go to Facebook, which I don't do, and then search for Friends of Ada Hayden. And you can take it to our Facebook page, and it should be there, too. So, yeah, that's kind of nice to watch that trail cam video of that bobcat.
Yeah.
And there's also a video of a great blue heron that swallows in one gulp a huge trout.
Oh.
That's been kind of neat.
Yeah, that's right. I'd forgotten about that. And speaking of your trout, are you seeing any of your otters?
Not recently, but I think the trail cam picks them up every so often in the park. So they're around. But with some of the wetlands freezing over, we're not finding them there much anymore.
Okay, yeah. But I think there was some evidence of maybe seeing young ones.
Yeah, yes. Yeah. This year, I think the trail cam caught what we call the gang of six. There was at least four or five young ones with the mom.
Uh-huh, which would be a big litter. Quite frankly, I don't know that the male in the couple would be present, but
no, I don't think he sticks around.
Yeah, it's kind of that way. He's probably up and down the river, but Ada Hayden has become kind of an otter nursery out there. And there was a time when even a conversation like this would be somewhat guarded. I never want to take river otters for granted, but boy, it's just special. The likelihood of seeing an otter in our lifetime at Ada Hayden is just beyond anybody's wildest dreams, almost.
And just watching them as they're swimming, looking for food, and then they're coming out and chewing on them, biting off the head and everything. It's just amazing to watch them.
Yeah, they're very...
They really enjoy life.
Yeah, they do. In fact, it seems like they have a zest for living that's exhibited in everything they do.
Right.
Well, is there anything else, Wolf, that comes to mind? Great having you on again.
Well, I would say if people have a chance, come out to the park. Even when it snows, they do clear the trail, the paved trail, so you can still walk around. It's always an enjoyable time.
Well, it is. It's a great resource, and it's wonderful that you have the time to, we can call you the weather's going to change again, and with that there'll be waterfowl piling into Ada Hayden, and it's good to know that Wolf Osterich is going to be tallying up and keeping track of what's occurring out there at our wonderful Ada Hayden resource.
Yep, and if you want to see what I'm seeing, I do the monthly reports at the website, so the October one is posted there.
Yeah.
And November will be posted sometime early in December.
Thanks a million, Wolf. Thanks for all you do for conservation.
Local Talk airs each weekday at 7 a.m. on 89.1 FM. KHOI Local Talk is a training workshop as well as a show. If you have an interest in joining the Local Talk team as a reporter, the welcome mat's out here at 622 Douglas Avenue.
KHOI provides a platform for citizens and public officials to air opinions and information. The views of our guests do not necessarily reflect those of KHOI. KHOI is a community, nonprofit, nonpartisan media in the highest regard. At community radio, you will hear items and stories you're not going to hear anywhere else. Community radio is unique that way. Thank you, Dennis Hart, with your summary of the news. Thank you, Local Talk producer Lynn Carey. And thank you, Mike Murphy, for engineering and all that you do for community radio. And thanks for the You Name It yesterday, and it's rebroadcast Monday at 9 p.m. Thanks to our guest, Dave Conrads. Thank you, Dave Conrads, with UI Wild. Gabrielle Edwards, Ames City Forester, and Wolf Osterich, Big Blue Stem Audubon. I've been your host, Pat Schlarbaum.
Our theme song, as always, is Backtracking by Tom Richards and Al Harris from their CD, The Ballad of Kate Shelley. The other artist you heard was Bill Miller, Not Too Far. Stay tuned now for Headline News and Democracy Now!, followed by Adagio at 9 a.m. And folks, while you're out there driving, keep an eye out for those deer, because the rut is still on. And that's the season for the deer to be on their move and somewhat judgmental, as far as they'll stand there and look at you like deer in the headlights. Remember, you, the listener, are what makes KHOI meaningful and possible. Thank you for listening, and thank you for supporting KHOI Community Radio. And we'll see you again on the radio.